Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point in Shanghai. I'm standing in People's Square in the middle of Shanghai. It's not like Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Shanghai Square is huge, but green. It feels, in April, a little bit like Central Park. Lots of trees, a wall of towers around. A few months ago, something extraordinary for China happened right here. Thousands of people marched into People's Square to protest the extension of a high-speed maglev train line through their neighborhood. And the protest worked. The project was dropped. In China, that is news. Almost amazing. Because most dissenters in China face a much grimmer outcome. Harassment, beatings, jail, worse. The Chinese government doesn't like to talk about it. But for the next hour, we will, with people who know the problem well. This hour, On Point, Dissent in China. I'm back in On Point's Shanghai studio now, just one subway stop from People's Square. And we're ready to turn to our panel of guests for this important hour, people who know the often hidden world of dissent and punishment well. Joining me now in Shanghai is Jerome Cohen, one of the world's top authorities on China's legal system. He's a professor at New York University School of Law and a senior fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been following the law and dissent in China for more than 30 years. Jerry Cohen, welcome to On Point in Shanghai.
Delighted to be here, Tom.
Joining us from New York is Sharon Hamm, Executive Director of Human Rights in China, a group that promotes democratic reform in China. She's a professor of law emerita at City University of New York School of Law and a board member of Human Rights Watch Asia. Sharon Hamm, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Boston is journalist Liu Xuying. She worked for the South China Morning Post from 2002 to 2007 in the southern province of Guangzhou and covered local protests there. She's currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University studying grassroots democracy in China. Xu Ying, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a big, important topic, a matter of life and death. There's a little bit of sound I want to get in our ears before we begin. Let's go back for just a moment. June 4th, 1989. Soldiers standing around student protesters in Tiananmen Square awaiting orders. The crowd taunts them. They open fire. Protest and death in Tiananmen, 1989. Fast forward to 2008. This month, activist Hu Jia, prominent human rights activist in Beijing, arrested earlier and sentenced this month to 3.5 years in prison after a long time under house arrest for inciting subversion of state power for his activism and his hot commentary online. A few months earlier, November 26, 2007, Hu Jia testified before the European Parliament's Human Rights Subcommittee. He spoke from house arrest in Beijing on a web phone link through an interpreter. He said that a human rights disaster was taking place in the country. He was critical of the Chinese Communist Party's intentions for the 2008 Beijing Olympics.
The Western society as well as the Chinese people were hoping the Olympics would bring China the democracy, the openness, the freedom, and the peacefulness. Although that the Chinese Communist Party wants to make this game, into make this opportunity into an opportunity to justify their ruling. And just like the 1936 Berlin, the Olympics in Nazi Germany, they want to make the Olympics just like that. It's really a big conflict. And it has the Chinese Communist Party has made many human rights disasters and also persecuting many people. And right now in China is the peak of this persecution.
Chinese dissident Hu Jia speaking there to the European Parliament's Human Rights Subcommittee in November of 2007. 5 months later, he was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison, where he sits as we speak this evening.
We know it's a big country and a big picture of what's going on here, but Jerry Cohen, I wish you'd help us begin to dive into it. We'll talk about individual situations, people, circumstances, but I wish you'd paint the big picture for us with dissent and punishment in China. What's going on? The volume and type of public dissent? Who's doing it? Over what issues? And then how the state responds.
Well, China is a huge country. Like other countries where expression freedoms are restricted, dissent covers a very wide swath. It ranges from terrorist acts, which the Chinese government has recently been emphasizing, to people who peacefully want to organize a democratic opposition party. You have other people who don't want to organize a party, but they do believe the Chinese Communist Party shouldn't have a monopoly on government. Then you have other people who were happy enough to see the communist monopoly of power continue, but they want to improve it in some way. They want reforms. Then you have other people who are just protesting certain actions or the suppression of their religion, for example. You have the famous Falun Gong people. It's hard to say whether that's a religion or exactly what it is, but they certainly have been radically suppressed. As you said, you've got environmental protesters. The most famous incident was in Xiamen, down in Fujian province, where it's an unpolluted, beautiful city, and masses of people every day peacefully demonstrated to stop a huge petrochemical plant. And that succeeded, and that was a precedent for the Shanghai incident.
That in People's Square just now.
That's right, that you open with. Shanghai and many places are plagued by dissent over forcible eviction. People are forced out of their central area living or accommodations, forced to move to the suburbs, and they don't want to change the system, but they think they're being treated unfairly. Then you got laborers, thousands of laborers who haven't been paid back wages, or they're protesting unsafe mining conditions where they're working or factory conditions. You've got neighborhoods that say, we don't want a hospital in our neighborhood. They're just protesting. They're not really against the government. They want the government to hear them. You've got AIDS discrimination, a very serious problem. People can't get jobs with government and often elsewhere because if it's known they have AIDS and their children may suffer in terms of going to school, etc. You've got ethnic problems. And of course, the most famous at the moment is the treatment of Tibet. But in a way, it obscures the treatment of people in Xinjiang province, where you've got a large Muslim population. Those people have the same problems that people who are Tibetans have. The Uyghur people. Mm-hmm. But they don't have a Dalai Lama to advertise their troubles. They don't even have Richard Gere. So the rest of China also has freedom of speech problems. But since they don't have the ethnic religious discrimination problems that Tibet and the Uyghurs have in Xinjiang, it's less severe. But we shouldn't overlook these are general problems. So the Chinese government has to figure out what to do about it.
Sharon Hamm in New York, that's a very, very wide range of angles of dissent. What does the Chinese government seem to be most sensitive about?
Well, I wouldn't presume to try to figure out what's going on inside the minds of the Chinese government, but from their actions, it's clear that maintaining the control over the situation is at the heart of most of the decisions. You can see that the smooth, successful Olympics, which is really what everyone wants, I think the Chinese authorities, the Chinese people in general, the sponsors, the IOC, the athletes, this is what everyone wants. Yet you can see by the actions it's taking, the rhetorical attacks that's over the top, the kind of cultural revolution rhetoric, labeling His Holiness the Dalai Lama as a terrorist, you know, this kind of stuff. It's avoiding, it shows where their real priorities are and what the trump card is. And the trump card is to maintain stability, which is slightly different than harmonious society, but stability, and to maintain the control by the party.
And Liu Shuying in Boston, when Chinese people cross the line, and we can see there are many lines here, many things that are sort of off limits, if you're seen to go too far. What happens? What's the range? You've seen some of it firsthand, but you know, what happens when you cross the Chinese line on dissent?
Well, the gut reaction is to send in the police, send in the armed police, break up, you know, protest, arrest people, the ringleaders, you know, so that, you know, to neutralize the protest. And there has also been cases recently during the 4.5 years that I was in Guangzhou, covering Guangdong province, where they use, they hired thugs to beat up villagers. And there were also cases where activists, reporters were beaten up and jailed.
So everything from house arrest and harassment to beatings by officials or hired thugs or jail. I'm looking here at some numbers, Jerry Cohen, about in spite of that threat of punishment, the incidence of protest in China growing and growing quite dramatically over the last decade and more. I've got numbers here that says 87,000 incidents, average of 50 people somehow out and expressing themselves in 2005. January to July of that year, 17 mass incidents with more than 10,000 people, 1,700 injured, 100 killed. There's a lot of action here, even if there's a lot of oppression at the same time. Jerome Cohen with me in Shanghai, Sharon Hahn in New York, Lu Su Ying in Boston. Please stand by. We're talking about dissent and punishment in China. I'm Tom Ashbrook in Shanghai. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point in Shanghai. We're talking this hour about dissent and punishment in China. My guest, Jerome Cohen. He's a top authority on China's legal system, professor at New York University School of Law. Sharon Hahn joins us from New York. She is with Human Rights in China, executive director there promoting democratic reform in China. Liu Xuying joins us from Boston. She worked for the South China Morning Post from 02 to 07 in southern China and was in the thick of it. There we'll hear more about that. Jerry Cohen is with me here in Shanghai. Let's listen for just a moment. This is the wife of the Chinese human rights activist Hu Jia, who was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for inciting subversion of state power by the Beijing Intermediate People's Court just this month. 34 years old, had been a fierce critic of China's policies on AIDS, the environment, Tibet, and more. Here is a moment where the BBC visited his wife, who had been confined to her flat. There were policewomen posing as residents trying to prevent the BBC from filming. The next day, the crew came back. His wife spoke to them from her apartment window.
On the afternoon of December 27th, I was feeding the baby in the bedroom. All of a sudden, I saw a strange man at the bedroom door. When I walked out, some women grabbed me and stopped me moving. I realized Hu Jia wasn't there anymore. I didn't know when they had taken him.
He's gone. He's in prison. The world has been paying attention on many fronts. Lots of debate over Tibet and more than that. Last month, Nancy Pelosi met with the Dalai Lama and encouraged the world to speak up for Tibet.
If freedom-loving people throughout the world do not speak out against China's oppression in China and Tibet, we have lost all moral authority to speak on behalf of human rights anywhere in the world.
Chinese media have responded, government-run media have responded very fiercely to Nancy Pelosi. I think I saw her described somewhere just the other day as the most hated woman in China or something like that lately. Jerry Cohen, here we're coming up on the Olympics. There was some expectation that China would look to improve its human rights record in advance of the Olympics. When you stand back and look at the big picture here, is the human rights picture in China getting better or worse?
Well, human rights covers a lot of behavior, but if we're talking, as I think we are, about political and civil rights, freedoms of expression,
yes,
it was, of course, pretty bad to begin with. It was hoped in the months before the Olympics things would relax, But what happens is the government is so sensitive to any criticism that could spoil the party that they've actually tightened up all kinds of restrictions. So it's had a paradoxical kind of effect. Maybe things will relax after the Olympics, but right now things have never been tighter under this current post-Cultural Revolution government.
Do you know this professor of Chinese law in Beijing, Deng Biao?
Yes, I know Deng Biao.
And I'm reading here a description of what happened to him recently in advance of the Olympics. Plainclothes officers seizing him outside his apartment, putting a sack over his head, driving him 40 minutes away, dropping him in a room where he's questioned for 2 days, sent back with a big warning that that he should stop writing articles about China's human rights, critical articles, particularly with regard to the Olympic Games, or things could get worse. Is that extraordinary or is that typical?
Unfortunately, the treatment of Deng Biao is quite typical in many respects. Informal harassment, people outside your house monitoring your behavior, telling you, yes, you can go to the office, but you can't go to the hotel to meet the visitor. There's all kind of informal restraints on people. I tried to see an ex-lawyer who's lost his license in Shanghai to visit him. There were six police outside his apartment. They wouldn't let me go visit him. I said, what authority have you got? And they just kept repeating, we're police. And I said in Chinese, I know you're police, but in Shanghai, shouldn't police have authority to do something? They just said, we're police. And there's a lot of, in other words, informal monitoring harassment. Sometimes, as in that Deng Biao instance, it gets rough. And sometimes the police do have hired thugs who, especially in the countryside, engage in pretty horrific behavior. A famous case that we haven't yet mentioned is that of the blind man Chen Guangcheng, who was a kind of barefoot lawyer. He hadn't formally studied law, but he was trying to help people who were protesting illegal abortions, illegal sterilizations, etc. And he's been treated miserably and sentenced to 4 years and 3 months in prison. He's a good friend of mine and an admirable person. So you have informal restraints, then you have the formal use of the criminal process. And the police often don't have to go to court or even to a prosecutor. They can just use what they call re-education through labor, which means the police themselves can decide to send you away for 3, or it could turn out to be even 4 years. So this is a very strong administrative punishment. And the death penalty, which China has been making progress in reducing in recent years, and China has been making important criminal justice reforms about reviewing death penalty adjudications. But the other day, last Friday, under the leadership, the new Supreme Court Chief Justice said, oh, we have to listen to the demands of the masses, as well as to the law and to social conditions. Well, what are the demands of the masses?
And whatever the Communist Party says they are?
Sure. Well, they're the interpreter of the masses. So what you're getting is maybe a certain revival of interest in doing more death sentences rather than fewer death sentences, because the party is getting pretty shaken up by all this concern that's going to rain on the party. So their social party, and as you said, nobody wants to have a bad Olympics. Sharon emphasized that. But the fact is it's working out badly, because repression leads to more protests, as we've seen in Tibet and we're beginning to see in Xinjiang.
Sharon Hum, how do you interpret the coming of the Olympics as it intersects with dissent and expression in China? I'm looking here at a report from Reporters Without Borders. Last month, a 5-year jail term from a leader of the Human Rights, Not Olympic Games campaign, Yang Chun-Lin, went to prison along with others who were sent for labor re-education, one confined to a psychiatric ward after brandishing a banner on the streets of Beijing last October that said, "We want human rights and democracy, not fascist Olympic Games." Are the Olympics, at the moment, they don't appear to be helping. Do you see them somehow helping long-term, or have they just led the party to tighten up overall, Sharon?
Well, first, I think that we have to be clear that the expectations that the Olympics would promote democracy, greater openness, and human rights were first articulated by the Chinese authorities themselves. This was back in 2001 during their bid for the Olympics. Trying to get the Olympics, it was the Chinese authorities and high officials connected with BOCOG, the Beijing Olympics, later on the officials, for the Olympics Committee for Beijing. They raised and said, if we got the Olympics and got to host it, this will promote and advance democracy and human rights. So the expectations that it would were quite reasonable by the NGOs, the human rights activists, and the international community, and by China's own people. We were totally reasonable to expect that it should have opened up, because that's what the authorities promised as part of their hosting bid. And then following getting the bid, they then disclosed in their action plan for the hosting of the Olympics very specific promises that have to do with the Green Olympics, has to do with the social development would advance, and that they would have a tight but friendly security, and that the technology end of it would advance greater access to richer information content. Instead, what we've seen is a disaster and exacerbation of the environment as it sucks all the water out from the surrounding provinces to provide the water for the Olympics. We see that social development in every aspect has really been deteriorated. And the high-tech Olympics, what you really see is the strengthening of the surveillance and monitoring infrastructure because of the state-of-the-art security systems being put in place by the Olympics. So I think that the Olympics, the legacy of it right now is looking that like it's going to really strengthen the regime. But before your question, so has the overall human rights situation improved or has it deteriorated? I think the question is for whom? It's for the economic and political elites, particularly those in the urban areas like in Shanghai or in Beijing. For them, clearly the situation has improved, but they are the vast, vast, small minority. And for the vast majority of China's people, the several hundred million migrants, the 700 to 800 million rural inhabitants, of whom 300 million, that is almost every man, woman, and child in the U.S., do not have access to clean drinking water and do not have access to basic health care. So when you think about SARS and all of these pandemics, this is really exacerbating the situation. Those are all human rights, the rights to decent housing and health care and education. So all of those, for the vast majority, has not improved. But
China's economy has improved so much. Can the government not claim that, look, the economy is up and that has brought improvements for millions and millions of people?
Yeah. That's the economy has grown, and that the double-digit growth is clearly not sustainable. And that's at the heart of one of the tensions and crisis that will be facing the authority. In order to not maintain power, but to maintain legitimate authority and credibility, they have to deliver on the economics. And the deal that was made with its own, you know, with the Chinese people post-1989 was democracy, no. Money, yes. So they were able to make money, but do not go for political reform. What's happening is that the growth is not sustainable, because you can't just have growth without fair, equitable growth. And even the party authorities themselves are addressing this, saying, yes, we must address the inequalities between the coastal and interior, between the rural and the urban, because if they don't address the fairness question and the distribution of the benefits from growth, their own credibility, legitimacy, and hold on power will be undermined.
Sharon, stand by. Liu Xiuying in Boston, I wish you'd give us a sense. You've done a lot of reporting in China. Give us a sense of how the Chinese people perceive this kind of wall against free expression or transgressions defined in many ways. Are they very aware? Do they feel like they live in a police state or in a free state with lines out there somewhere? Are they very aware that they could be monitored? Do people speak freely or not at home, in the streets? Give us a sense of how ordinary Chinese people feel on this front. Oppressed or not?
Certainly, I would say they feel oppressed, and they are very aware that whatever they try to do, you know, if they trying to organize any protest, they would be under surveillance. I covered a protest in the village of Taishi in Guangzhou in 2005. And the people I got in touch with are extremely careful in how they communicate with reporters.
These were not big city sophisticates.
No, this is a village of about 2,000 people. You know, it's yes, of course, it's not far from Guangzhou, and they are exposed to they are allowed to watch television from Hong Kong, so they have a lot of influence from Hong Kong.
Right, but they were upset because, as I recall the story, they felt that the party leadership, the leadership in the village was corrupt, and they wanted to change it. What kind of protest did they make, and what happened in response?
Yeah, what happened was that they were protesting against this village head because... they were getting poorer.
They said he had bribed his way to victory in the vote there, and maybe siphoned off a lot of money in village funds.
Exactly, that was what he was doing. So the villagers were getting poorer, but you know, all around it, they can see that the economy was booming. So they couldn't figure out, you know, how the sums, you know, worked out. So they decided.
How did they show their unhappiness? What did they do?
Well, usually it started like, yeah, we want to protest, you see, as a petition to the government, you know, to redress this problem. So, but what happened was that some activists, democracy activists in Beijing found out about their problem and decided that, look, you know, you can do it a legal way, you know, you elected this village head and the election law allows you to recall him. So why don't you do it in a legal way and not get into trouble with the government? So they launched a petition to recall the village head, and the petition was rejected. So they started to protest, you see, and this protest was like, you know, put down by, you know, hundreds and, you know, up to 1,000, you know, police officers.
Riot and police coming into this.
Yes,
village.
And you see, these people were, the leaders were like, you know, very conscious that, you know, they were under surveillance, so they were careful when using their handphones. They try to, like, change SIM cards all the time, or they use their handphones only to make...
On their cell phones, right?
Yeah, the cell phones, you know, just to send text messages, you know, so, you know, it's harder to see where these messages are coming from. But
nevertheless, the police had targeted particular people. I've seen reports of a guy pulled out of a taxi cab on his way home and beaten senseless by the side of the road in this case.
This is the case of an activist who was going to the village, you know, with a foreign reporter, he was beaten up, and he was, you know, beaten up quite badly. And
when you went to cover this story, you were followed, threatened with strip search, picked up by the police. Is this typical? What happens when even in your case, foreign reporter went to cover a story?
Well, I think before the Taishi case, I think there were very few such incidents, you know, I mean, where foreign reporters are concerned. And, I was repeatedly detained and on the pretext that I wasn't carrying my passport, and when I had my, you know, press accreditation card with me, and they refused to recognize my press card. They insisted that, you know, I show them my passport, and when I didn't have it, you know, that was an excuse for detaining me, and it was a way to harass me. And because, you know, the passport is such a valuable document, you know, reporters in the past.
Of course, you need it. Who won the Taishi standoff, the villagers or the government?
Well, the government won it because, you know, as I've said, you know, earlier on, that they arrested people, they sent out groups of workers, you know, fanned out among the villagers, you know, telling them, you know, to give up the petition, otherwise they're going to lose their job, or their loved ones are going to lose their jobs, or their children will not be allowed to go to school. Or
village dissent there in southern China. We have to take a short break. Lu Chu Ying, Sharon Ham, Jerome Cohen, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook in Shanghai. We're talking about dissent in China. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point in Shanghai. We're talking this hour about dissent and punishment in China. I'm joined by Jerome Cohen. He's with me in Shanghai, professor, New York University School of Law, a longtime authority on Chinese law and dissent. From New York, Sharon Hom is with us, executive director of human rights in China. From Boston, Lucy Ying. She worked for the South China Morning Post in southern China, covering grassroots movements there. I want to play a piece of tape right here from just last month, March 22nd. This was a petition signed by quite a significant number of leading Chinese intellectuals and writers appearing on several websites in Chinese. It was headlined 12 Suggestions for Dealing with the Tibetan Situation. And I want to ask, after we listen to this, what's okay and what's not? Here's this group of intellectuals in English translation calling on the Chinese government.
In our opinion, such cultural revolution-like language as "the Dalai Lama is a jackal in Buddhist monk's robes and an evil spirit with a human face and the heart of a beast," used by the Chinese Communist Party leadership in the Tibet Autonomous Region, is of no help in easing the situation, nor is it beneficial to the Chinese government's image. As the Chinese government is committed to integrating into the international community, we maintain that it should display a style of governing that conforms to the standards of modern civilization.
There's just one of the 12 points, Jerry Cohen, and it's signed. It's out there. It's public. That means that some forms of dissent, or at least criticism, can be voiced. So where's the line?
Well, the line shifts from time to time, depending on who's talking, what the political situation is at the time. And most people know how to maneuver in order to stay out of jail. But occasionally they're surprised. And sometimes people get carried away emotionally and they say or do things that in a calmer moment they might not have done. You know, China has a very vast secret police organization. If you go to Pakistan, you see military and police officers everywhere, mm-hmm. and you have no doubt what kind of a country you're in.
Mm-hmm.
But China, when you go to Beijing, Shanghai, other cities, there's a high degree of apparent prosperity. People are eating and drinking like there's no tomorrow. Everybody looks like his life has improved. And many of these people, the winners in China's great modernization and successful transformation, they aren't even aware that the secret police are operating anymore. A lot of these people, they're urban, successful professionals. They're a new entrepreneurial generation.
They really don't know, or they know but choose not to worry about it because they're not complaining about anything. The system's working for them.
It doesn't bother them. They're not aware, and they aren't bothered. But it's the people who are what the French would call the déracinés, the uprooted. They aren't winners. Some are losers. Some have made progress, but relative to what's going on around them, they're dissatisfied. This is a modern phenomenon in the modernization of many developing countries. We saw it in Iran. We've seen it elsewhere. So these people need an outlet. And Chinese political legal institutions aren't sufficient to provide a safe outlet, an institutional arrangement for channeling grievances in a peaceful fashion. People try to petition. The petitions, usually over 99%, are unsuccessful. They try administrative negotiations. Mm-hmm. They try the courts. The courts are often not eager to take these cases and won't, or if they take them, they don't know what to do with them. They're hot potatoes. People find they have to go to mass protests in order to be heard. So China needs institutional reform to match its economic progress, but it isn't happening. And I think the current leadership after the 17th Party Congress is even more conservative than it was before. So I think the Tibet thing, I hope, will signal to the leadership the importance of following a new policy. The advice that these intellectuals gave in these 12 points is very good advice, very sound advice. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them in the future...
And they were willing and brave enough to put it out there with their names on it.
And some of them may later suffer. Teng Biao, whom you mentioned, is a wonderful young law professor, very idealistic, very active. He joined Hu Jia in writing certain critiques of the government. And he's been restricted from time to time. He's been threatened with loss of his academic job. But he keeps punching. But at some point, the government may decide it loses patience, just as it did finally with Hu Jia. There is a period of sort of tolerance where the government is waiting and watching and hoping people will relent. But some people don't relent, and new events occur that cause them to make further criticism of the government.
But people know. I've seen just in this week in Shanghai, people freeze in a certain circumstance just at the mention of a word that's, you know, not supposed to be in the lexicon. You know, at the mention of an issue that's too sensitive, people just freeze with fear, great fear, at the potential consequences of being anywhere near that. Sharon?
Yeah, if I could jump in on that. Jerry will know, and Siu Yun will know. I mean, in Chinese, san bu ti, it's very clear when you're in a society where information is controlled and where it's dissent and what's permissible. Not only is the line crossing, you won't know until you cross it. But san bu ti, the three things you really can't raise without a lot of sensitivity is Tibet, Taiwan, and Tiananmen. And for your listeners, is to point out that one of the signers of that open letter includes Ding Zilin, who is the spokesperson and one of the main voices for the Tiananmen mothers, a group of family members of victims and students and others killed and in prison still some from 1989 June. And she signed that, and not only that petition, but for the last 19 years has sent open letters every year on the anniversary or at important events to the leaders, most recently saying, we ask for dialogue, we ask to sit down to talk about the truth, investigation, compensation, apology, and naming the event for what it was. You
ever any response to that?
No, and they didn't get any of the previous responses. And then most recently, this open letter asking for dialogue, this came in the wake of the Chinese authorities announcing they would come back to the table with the U.S. and restart some kind of dialogue. So I think it would be not good to interpret what is permissible as signs of progress. Because from the human rights perspective and a real independent civil society perspective, that is just an oxymoron. You cannot have civil society voices that are permitted. The purpose of civil society is to allow us to have that independent space to say and have that expression and to have the practice. So that's what's not happening in China, is that being
I understand
what's
that. Let me ask about that then in the context of this particular event that we opened the show with, this January. It looked like a protest march, but they were afraid to call it that. They called it a collective walk into People's Square in Shanghai. Let's listen to just a little bit of what went on to thousands of people in the center of Shanghai in broad daylight in January. Jerome Cohen, that sounds like a protest to me. They didn't want to call it that. It was against the extension of this very high-speed maglev train. Travels 250 or more miles an hour now from downtown Shanghai to one of the airports here. There they were, right out in public, thousands of them. Now, we read that afterward, you know, scores of police officers went into those neighborhoods that they had come from. People were briefly arrested. They were forced to erase digital photos of those, sign confessions. But, of course, the video is up on YouTube. Others told that they might lose their job if they talked about it, news media coverage of it banned. Nevertheless, it happened. It was middle class, too. Now, how do you interpret what went on there?
Well, we've seen, as I said earlier, the same thing in Xiamen. In some urban areas,
coastal cities south of here,
where you have popular issues that don't threaten the regime. Nobody was calling for the organization of a free democratic party. Nobody was calling for the end of Communist Party rule. They were just saying, stop a railroad that's harming our personal lives and environment. And it was a very reasonable demand.
And the government acceded on this point, as they did in the southern city of Xiamen
earlier. Yes, that was an environmental point. The government saw the people had a reasonable base, and they had huge mass support for that day after day. In those circumstances, you have a good possibility for getting a hearing, getting reconsideration, and trying to satisfy the crowds.
They had wanted to put a big chemical plant in an urban area there.
That's
yet,
right.
and they didn't. But that event and the event in Shanghai attracted a lot of attention. I mean, Beijing's really concerned about this. You say maybe if it doesn't go at core interest, they may be all right with it.
You see, this can spread if you have successful examples in Xiamen and in Shanghai. Then other people elsewhere in the country are going to be trying this. So this is a dangerous thing because you can't have masses of people entering the public squares in every city in China, even if they have righteous indignation because they've got a good cause. Sometimes protests occur because they've given a big hike to bus fares. Sometimes protests occur because they're discriminating against people who come from another province. But sometimes protests occur because they really want to overthrow the village leadership. They feel the leadership of this place or that place is corrupt, and they're unable to use the village election process to achieve their goal. So it depends on what the goal is as well as what the method is and whether the government thinks its security is at stake.
Is there an answer somewhere out there? You've pushed law in China for a long, long time. You wrote not long ago that so far the party has avoided bold reform on the genuine rule of law. At a minimum, you've written, that would demand that the party give up its power to dictate decisions in individual court cases and would put the party in government under the law, not above it. Is there a chance under heaven that that could happen?
Well, it depends on your time frame. The situation today is far different from 30 years ago when China began under Deng Xiaoping its fabulous modernization effort. At that time, there were very few skilled legal people. China had been through over a decade of political struggle, and there hadn't been much legal education or training. Today, you have huge numbers of legal experts, many of them younger people, many idealistic people. They're devoting their lives to improving the legal system. You've got a couple of 100,000 judges, 150,000 prosecutors, 140,000 lawyers. You have a huge number of legal officials in the legislatures of the country, in every public agency, in every major corporation now. You have, in other words, a whole series of legal elites that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. And these people want change. They want a genuine legal system. But what's been lacking is leadership at the top. The Politburo Standing Committee hasn't given the kind of leadership that real law reform will require.
You've written that all the way back in 1989 when Gorbachev visited Beijing, and this was not long before the Tiananmen crackdown. Some of the students there in the square at that time were saying sort of ruefully that their Gorbachev was still in high school. In other words, it was a generation maybe away or something like that. If that were true, today he'd be, in his mid-30s. Is there somebody out there emerging in that kind of reforming role?
Well, given this kind of system, it's hard to tell what an official really thinks until he or she reaches the pinnacle of power.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get to the leadership of the country, then you can see, is this person really concerned about the kinds of issues that have to be dealt with? Nobody knew Khrushchev would engage in de-Stalinization until he gained power at the 20th Party Congress in 1956. Nobody knew Gorby was going to try to restructure the country, even though he'd been to law school. Now, recently, they put into the Standing Committee of the Politburo the first law graduate the Chinese communist leadership has ever had, Mr. Li Keqiang.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether he's going to be one of the people who can sensitize the leadership to the need for institutional legal change, we don't know, because until now, advocating the rule of law has not been the route to power in a communist system.
Lu Xuying, you've been out in the grassroots plenty, reporting in all those years, in southern China in particular. What's your sense? Let's say in Taishi, those villagers got tied up with the intellectuals and activists out of Beijing. They were made aware of some of their formal rights. They got kind of a bigger view of the world. did ordinary people there, far from Beijing, begin to have, you know, a widely held sense that there was something better that they wanted when it came to free expression, rights, the ability to just complain. Do they want it? Do they express it, or are they giving up?
Oh, definitely. they were totally in favor of, you know, going, using the law, you know, to defend their rights. You see, so you see people lining up, you know, to put their fingerprints on documents, you know, seeking a recall of this village chief. What was interesting about Taishi is that, you know, the involvement of intellectuals training these people on the their rights under the village election law. But they went for classes, so they knew exactly, you know, what they can or cannot do. And they wanted to stay out of trouble with the government. But I want to bring an even more interesting case that happened 2 years earlier. And
we've just got half a minute. Give it in a nutshell.
This is a group of villagers who were evicted from their homes on an island and to build, you know, for the construction of a college town. And they did not have any help from anybody, but they went out and bought books, law books, you know, and they were reading up on their land rights, you know, so that they knew that, you know, they, you know, the compensation they were getting was not right. And
we've got 20 seconds. Yes. Did they win or lose?
They did not lose, isn't it? But the interesting thing is that they went out to study the law themselves. These are farmers, you know, with very little education, you know, so the law was very, very important to them. So I think more and more people are going to realize that, you know, they need to educate themselves, you know, on their rights, you know, their legal rights.
There may be hope if there's pressure from that level. Sharon Hamm, we've just got a few seconds here. Are you hopeful?
Yes.
Do you see signs of hope?
Yes, we have to be hopeful. In addition to the law, we have to think about what Xu Xinying was referring to, which is change from the bottom up and support for that from the bottom up. And that's going to also require the Chinese leadership to address the fundamental problems and the fundamental solutions, not look for hiring more PR firms to handle the crisis and manage that.
And with that, we're out of time. Listeners, for more information on the history of protests in China, go to our website, onpointradio.org/China. Jerome Cohen, Sharon Hamm, Liu Xiu Ying. Thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook in Shanghai. This is On Point.